Who is God? Dear Lily, religion is usually defined as a belief in some entity or entities who exist alongside but outside this material world. It can be one person, as in the monotheistic one God, that is, systems of Judaism, Christianity and Islam, or the many gods of Hinduism, Shinto, Taoism, and certain forms of Buddhism. In the West, where the prevailing belief is in one God, creator and sustainer of the world, lovingly concerned with his children, there are rituals to keep close contact with this father figure. At birth, marriage, and death, God joins his family, ratifying and consoling. At certain times of the year, he is asked to bless, and in times of trouble, he is lent on for support. Questions are put to him. Why is there so much pain in the world? What happens when we die? And the answers are usually found in his holy word, the Bible. This gives rule of conduct in the Ten Commandments and in the Sermon on the Mount. Divided into a multitude of sects, often at war with one another, this religion shares enough common beliefs to give it one name, Christianity. In this and other religions, there are sacred spaces, godly areas set apart from the everyday concerns of our lives. In these, prayers are directed at the All-Powerful One, who is pleaded with and cajoled, but not, as in magic, commanded. In the West, a set of beliefs defines Christianity, which is both its strength and its weakness, since it can be divisive and intolerant. In other parts of the world, there is often a more relaxed attitude. Different beliefs and rituals can be blended together. In a Nepalese village where I work, for example, a person may call in a Hindu Brahmin to do a puja for success, and then later bury an elderly relative with the help of a Buddhist Lama, and then try to cure a sick relation with a shamanic ritual. In Japan, belief is partly dealt with by Western philosophy or by Buddhism. Many rituals are performed by Shinto priests, and ethics are partly catered for by Confucianism. There is no single system. When I asked a group of Japanese schoolchildren what their religion was, they were mystified. They did not recognize the word religion. There is no such word in Japanese, or recognize something which we would call religion. And yet, they were surrounded by temples and shrines and little processions. This often makes it very difficult for Japanese or Chinese visitors to understand Western societies. Even a relatively secular country like England seems to them to be highly vicious, full of the assumptions of religion. There are traces of God in our philosophy, poetry, art, and everyday life, and nothing makes sense unless we see the ghost of Christianity behind it. Many foreigners, particularly outside from outside Europe, think of us, whether we go to church or not, as religion-soaked. Where is the sacred? The distinction between the sacred and the profane is more complicated than it looks. If we go up to the altar of a church, we feel we are in a sacred place. Yet there are many other places and actions that feel special. A cremation, a prayer before a meal, a moment of national celebration or mourning. Are these sacred? In much of the West, after the Protestant Reformation, the division into sacred and profane was undermined. All of this world became a profane, secular sphere, and God was removed to another, more distant, sacred space. So there is no obvious distinction of the kind felt in many religions, whereby a particular day, place, relic, or icon is sacred. Many Westerners lack a strong idea of sacredness in their lives. On the other hand, in many societies, it is the opposite. Everything is, to a certain extent, sacred. In the Nepalese village, all of life is simultaneously and potentially sacred and profane at the same time. There is a little godling living in the fireplace, another in a basket in the corner of the living room, another in a bowl of water, others on the doorstep and round the eaves of the house. There are numerous godlings in large trees or rocks. Divinity lurks everywhere, and its power can be activated at any time by an appropriate ritual. Religion is impossible to define precisely because it has so many different features. Yet not all of them will be found in any specific society or in the same combination. This helps to explain the fact that though there can be no societies without a code of what is right and what is wrong, there have been some where it has not been possible to find a sense of a particular god or gods. Are right and wrong the same everywhere? In many societies, murder is immoral. In others, it is, in certain circumstances, considered the highest of moral acts. In many, sexual intercourse between unmarried people is sinful. But in the majority, there is nothing wrong with it. In many, it is fine to lie to a stranger. In others, one should never do so. It is even more confusing because ethical systems seem to be blown about the world by the winds of change. In my life, I have seen sexual ethics totally transformed from those prevailing when I was brought up. The concepts of right and wrong are being radically altered by genetic engineering, which affects our basic attitudes to the borders between the natural and the artificial. If we look at the ethics of our own country in the past, we can see that they were very different from those today. Furthermore, in most societies, ethics are not universal, but contextual. The morality or immorality of lying, killing, or eating someone all depends on the circumstances. We know this in a mild way in that thou shalt not kill, a biblical exhortation, evaporates quickly in war. Or similarly, thou shalt not steal is forgotten in a famine. Or exhortations not to lie by someone facing life in a concentration camp. Yet it is even more extreme than this. The ethical system usually varies for different castes or classes, for men and women, differs according to whether one is dealing with relatives or not, differs if one is treating members of one's own or another ethnic group. One of the astonishing features of parts of Western society is that not only do we have a strong ethical system, which we pursue as an ideal at least, but the foundation of this, the idea of innate human rights, is now proclaimed as not only incontestable, but universal. These rights are believed to apply everywhere on the planet, to men, women, rich, poor, old, young, irrespective of class or kinship. This is an extraordinary claim. Furthermore, such rights are increasingly disassociated from God or a particular religion. Rather, they are based on ideas about what is the ultimate nature of human beings. Love, respect, do as you would be done by. So ethical codes have become more relative. We are aware of their limitations and the variations around the world. Certain old standards, for example, in sexual behavior, have been abandoned. Yet ethical standards have simultaneously become more universal. They are now increasingly based on the local traditions developed in Western Europe and America, and are spread by a combination of military and technological supremacy. It is a truly confusing world. Does religion mirror this world? In most societies, and over most of time, it was believed that God or the gods came first, and then they created humankind, often in their own image. Increasingly, this was questioned. In the 19th century, many people described religion as something constructed by humans rather than God making humans. People made the gods to be like themselves. Indeed, the idea that we construct God rather than the other way around is an old one, reaching back to the ancient Greeks. Later, in the 16th century, Montaigne wrote, "Man is quite insane. He wouldn't know how to create a maggot, and he creates gods by the dozen." 2 centuries later, another French philosopher, Montesquieu, referred to a very good saying that if triangles invented a god, they would make him three-sided. This seems to make sense the moment we look at a range of societies. Since it becomes obvious that their ideas of God, heaven and hell vary enormously. Those who herded animals, like the people who created the religions of Judaism, Christianity and Islam, had a picture of God as the patriarch or father figure of a tribe of herdsmen who wanted animals as a gift. Those who grew grains and lived in settled villages often had a variety of smaller gods and larger gods who reflected their diversity, as in Hinduism, Taoism or Shinto. It is even possible to find direct mirrors of this world in the ideas of heaven. In a Nepalese village, the dead spirits are believed to live in an exact copy of the ordinary village, in a soul village. People keep similar animals there, eat similar grains, dance in the same way as they do on earth, and live in houses like those they occupied when they were alive. The only difference is that there is no disease, no hard work, or death. The whole idea of such a projection is described by the English poet Rupert Brooke, imagining the heaven of some fish. Fish, say, they have their stream and pond, but is there anything beyond? The fish concluded that somewhere beyond space and time is wetter water, slimier slime. In such a world of the fish's heaven, everything is perfect. Oh, never fly conceals a hook, fish say, in the eternal brook. But more than mundane weeds are there, and mud celestially fair. Unfading moths, immortal flies, and the worm that never dies. And in that heaven of all their wish, there shall be no more land, say fish. There is obviously something in this idea that heaven is often just a mirror image of what is found on earth. When people live in a small-scale society where everyone's experiences and values are roughly the same, it is possible to make a heaven which is like this, but without the pain. Having made such a heaven and a God who presides over it, the moral rules of the present society and the present arrangements seem to be endorsed by an apparently separate supernatural order. God and heaven mirror this world, and this world should mirror God and heaven. Yet constructing a heaven is usually more complicated than this. People in most societies have for a long time become divided by class or caste, by gender and by occupation. If one group were designing heaven, it would look like one thing. Another group would design it in another way. Hence, feminists see God as a she. Young people would prefer her young, and black people may not be too keen on her being white. The only solution is to make God, heaven, and the spiritual world as vague and abstract as possible, as in Anglican Christianity. In the Anglican heaven, as I learnt about it when I pressed my teachers on the subject, there are clouds and a vague fatherly figure, but the rest is up to the believer to fill in. dead friends and relatives can be placed in the context of one's own choice. You, Lily, as a child, invented your own heaven where, as you explained to me, an endless game of pass the parcel took place. Each person won a prize when they unwrapped a layer of the parcel, and the prizes were their heart's desire. What is sin? A society with a religion of rules imparts a strong sense of sin. To break the ethical rule is bound to displease God or the gods. In Christianity, masturbation, lying and cheating are widely thought to be sins that God will punish. On the other hand, in the majority of societies, where ethics are one thing and religion and ritual another, it is different. In Japan, for instance, breaking rules of sexual behavior might lead to social sanctions, but it does not upset a god or the gods. So when the Christian missionaries arrived in Japan in the 16th century, they found one of their most difficult tasks was to persuade the Japanese that they were sinful. There was no such word or concept as sin. Many Japanese could see little reason to adopt a religion that preached salvation from the consequences of sin through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, who had taken upon him the sins of the world. It was a problem. The same problem was faced by missionaries in other parts of the world. In many tribal societies, people were believed to be good or bad human beings, moral or immoral, kind or unkind. Yet this had nothing to do with whether they would go to heaven or to hell. Indeed, in most of these societies, there was a belief only in a heaven. There was no hell at all, just a rebirth into this world in another form, or a land where all the dead went. So again, the missionaries had first to persuade people of their sinfulness, and then to provide the remedy in their teaching, just as merchants had to persuade people they needed their goods before trying to sell them. One way some people have tried to explain the difference between attitudes is to note that on the one hand, in the majority of societies, people feel shame when they do bad things, particularly if they are found out. The failure is in relation to other people. On the other hand, there are religions, such as Christianity, where people feel a sense of guilt. That is to say, people experience an inner feeling that they have betrayed something beyond this human society. Even if they are never found out in their lies or sexual misbehavior, God will know, and they will feel guilty. Robinson Crusoe on his island clearly felt guilt at certain times, although there was no one else, as he thought, on the island. This was because he had a sense of an invisible God watching him. The opposition between shame and guilt is a little oversimple, but it is a useful way to start to try to understand the difference. Too much sense of sin and guilt has weighed down and even destroyed many people. Equally, an absence of a sense of sin and guilt has turned others into what are called amoral supermen. That is, people with no real sense of good and bad. A little more sense of sin and guilt might not have been amiss in the case of Stalin, Hitler, or Chairman Mao, while others perhaps might benefit from a little less of the anxious and guilt-ridden feelings they have as they move through their lives. Does evil really exist? It is not widely recognized that evil with a capital E and the devil with a capital D are so closely linked as to be inseparable. In the Lord's Prayer, "Deliver us from evil," used to be at one time, "Deliver us from the devil." Yet the word evil with a capital E has come back into fashion lately, with a great deal of talk of this or that action being utterly evil with a capital E, or the empire of evil, or the axis of evil. So what is evil, and does it really exist? There are clearly many wrong, immoral, or criminal thoughts and actions, and when we condemn them, we call them evil. In this sense, we refer to antisocial acts or as evil. We consider rape, cruelty to animals, serious lying, incest, the shooting of children in a school, and many other things to be evil. That is seriously not good. No one would have difficulty with this. In this sense, almost all behavior, if carried to extremes or done for the wrong reason, can turn into evil. In the words of the poet William Blake, "A truth that's told with bad intent beats all the lies you can invent." The problem comes when a bishop or politician condemns a barbaric murder or genocide or terrorist attack as evil with a capital E. Sometimes the use of this word is an attempt to deal with the extreme feelings of revulsion and outrage people feel. To call something absolutely evil is the strongest condemnation we can make. Hitler, or a suicide bomber who kills dozens of innocent civilians, is condemned as pure evil. The word gets its power from the often hidden connections with its history and the link with the devil. An evil person with a capital E or act is completely unacceptable. People often feel that there is no purpose in trying to understand it, no way we should try to think whether we too might have done such a thing in the situation of the person we condemn. It is pure corruption, pure irrationality, pure evil intention. Evil comes from some dark force that hovers on the edge of our world. Satan, the devil, the Antichrist, the opposite of God. This absolute evil is sustainable only in a world that believes in the radical opposition between good, God, and evil, the devil. Most civilizations do not have this opposition. Some Japanese may consider the dropping of atom bombs on their cities as evil, with a small e. Yet since they have no Satan or devil, a concept absent in Hinduism, Buddhism, Shinto, and Taoism, they cannot think of a conspiracy of evil, of pure evil. why does God allow so much pain? One of the greatest puzzles facing all of those who seek meaning in this world is how to reconcile a loving, caring, and all-powerful Creator with the horrors we find every day in the newspapers and on television and in our personal lives. It was a problem seriously examined by Shakespeare, whose character, King Lear, concludes that as flies to wanton boys are we to the gods, they kill us for their sport. And by William Blake, who asks the tiger, did he who made the lamb make thee? And by Tennyson, when he tried to understand why his dear friend had died, but could see around him only nature red in tooth and claw. And by Joseph Heller, when he half facetiously wrote, good God, how much reverence can you have for a supreme being who finds it necessary to include such phenomena as phlegm and tooth decay in his divine system of creation? We seem to be trapped. If God is what he is proclaimed to be, why does he allow this suffering? Or putting it another way, can I believe in a God who seems to preside over such mayhem? Where was God in the Rwandan genocide? Where was he in the death trenches of the world wars, or in Stalin's gulag, or Hitler's concentration camps, or Pol Pot's killing fields? Where was he in the floods, fires, volcanoes, earthquakes, and tornadoes? The conventional answers do not totally satisfy. We're told that humans brought all this pain on themselves through an act of disobedience, that we are being punished for our original sin. But surely God, being supremely wise and all-powerful, could have foreseen this outcome and killed the serpent, or provided an alternative apple tree, or talked to the over-ambitious angel out of rebelling. Another suggestion is that God, like a loving parent who gives his children the exercise of free will, has to allow them to make mistakes and hence to suffer. If a small child were to be sheltered from all risks, it would have to be locked up in a padded cell. God made us a wonderful world in which we can make good or bad choices, and the latter can lead us into dangerous situations, injury or death. This sounds vaguely plausible, but of little comfort. An alternative solution in some religions is to treat the world as a painful illusion. There are a set of trials and apparent miseries from which we can withdraw into our own inner selves and await the bliss of nirvana or extinction. Another alternative is to accept that biology, society, and economics control our lives. We do appear to have some free will, and we will try to increase happiness for ourselves and others. Yet, in the end, human and something that constantly asks us to wonder. Yet in the end, pain is present from the moment we are born. It is part of being human, and something that constantly asks us to wonder, with the philosopher Nietzsche, is man one of God's blunders, or is God one of man's blunders?